Florida Republicans invite a convicted felon and conspiracy theorist to speak at their annual summit.
Is your school district ready to pay for armed security?
And the state Supreme Court will decide if lawmakers are adequately funding public schools.
This is the Florida Roundup, statewide edition, from WLRN Public Media in Miami and WJCT Public Broadcasting in Jacksonville. I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Melissa Ross. This week in Florida politics, some top Republicans aren't happy about a controversial speaker invited to the party's annual conference. Meanwhile, a familiar Democratic name returns to compete for a race in Central Florida. And that governor's race may get another Republican candidate next week.
Also, how prepared are public schools to have armed security in time for the next school year? You can join the conversation. 305-995-1800 on the Florida Roundup statewide edition is next. Welcome to the Florida Roundup. It's the statewide edition this hour. Thanks for listening. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Well, what a week it was in Florida politics. Lots to talk about this Friday, beginning with the fact that some top Republicans aren't too happy with a speaker booked at their party's big conference. Meanwhile, a familiar Democrat wants his old job back on Capitol Hill, and we're also waiting to learn if the Florida Speaker of the House will run for governor.
You know, sometimes, Melissa, it feels like it's the fall already with all these political comings and goings and not entering into this. Not even summertime yet, for goodness sakes, in this election year. So let's begin here as we pull through all of this. The Sunshine Summit, it's the summer conference for Florida Republicans, comes up next month. And this year, one of the invited speakers does not count as fans, many top Republicans here in the Sunshine State. Dinesh D'Souza is a convicted felon and conservative firebrand. He mocked Marjorie Stoneman Douglas students on Twitter. He later apologized for that. Governor Rick Scott and the incoming Florida State Senate President Bill Galvano have criticized the GOP invitation to him.
Now, the Republican Party of Florida has responded to all of that criticism around D'Souza by adding a speaker to the roster who's been critical of D'Souza in the past. It's Matt Schlapp. He's chair of the American Conservative Union. We are beginning our Florida Roundup this Friday with a look at politics around the state. Get on the line now and join the conversation at 305-995-1800 as we welcome Mary Ellen Kloss. She's the Miami Herald Tallahassee Bureau Chief. She's on the line from WFSU in Tallahassee. Also joining the show this Friday, Sergio Bustos, Senior Editor for Politico, joining from Doral. Mary Ellen Kloss, let's begin with you. So the Florida GOP has caught some flack for this booking of D'Souza, in addition to making the comments that really upset, in particular, parents down in Parkland, Florida, about the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas shooting. He's also a convicted felon. He was convicted in 2014 of felony campaign finance fraud. Critics of this move have pointed out that if D'Souza lived in Florida, he would not be eligible to vote as a convicted felon. So what do you make of the way the governor and the incoming Senate president have tried to get ahead of this? Do you think they've made an effective counter move with booking Matt Schlapp to also speak?
I just look at all of this as just another reflection of the infighting and divisive problems that the Republican Party faces. Now, if you step back and look at RPOF Chair Blaise Ngoglia as the guy who did the invite for D'Souza, he was the handpicked party chair of Richard Corcoran. And I think that this invitation is designed to attract and to appeal to the base of, or certain members of the base of the Republican Party who are pretty, you know, far on the right and to the extreme. And to some degree, Richard Corcoran has been working very hard to appeal to that base. I don't know if Blaise Ngoglia is independently making these decisions or if he consults with Richard Corcoran on everything, but I know that they are extremely close. So what I think that's what's going on here. Then you've got Rick Scott and to some degree Bill Galvano. Bill Galvano is going to face, you know, is the incoming Senate president, and he's going to have to face a lot of races that are very tight and close, including in Miami-Dade County mm-hmm. and Tampa Bay. And he's got to be a little bit more in the middle. And as we know, Rick Scott has been consistently moving to the middle on everything. So I think that's what's going on with
this. Sergio, if this is an effort a little bit on the Florida Republican Party to shift a little bit to the right to appeal to the further right-hand part of the Republican Party in Florida, Ron DeSantis, a gubernatorial candidate who occupies that lane, and we've talked a little bit about that, he has come out and has been somewhat critical of this invitation to Mr. D'Souza as well.
It all makes more of a distraction for a party that, as Mary Ellen says, is, you know, they're divided even among themselves. But this kind of thing just opens up that wound or opens up that divide even further and then exposes it to the public, which, of course, they would not like to do. I thought it was really funny that there was some people telling us that Blaze ought to be changing his GOP handle to Blaze Screws GOP. Hashtag Blaze Screws GOP. And that's the kind of thing, again, it's more of a distraction. Things will get past it, but those things, when they come up again and again, they just prove to be a really difficult thing for the party to kind of wrestle with at a time when they're trying to solidify a message. And essentially, they have two elections going on. There's the primary, as Marilyn says, and then there's the general. And it's hard to pivot when you've got these things going on.
But didn't this you know, the move to the right, it was successful for Republicans in 2016 here in Florida?
Well, it's always going to be a very close election, so it reflected the time there where you had Trump coming in, who just ended up with this kind of raw message out there that people liked. Will that same message do well in 2018 when maybe the mood of the country's changing? You know, it remains to be seen.
Yeah, Mary Ellen Kloss, what about that? In some of these tight races, particularly Governor Scott, who's now seeking a U.S. Senate seat against Democrat Bill Nelson, that's expected to be the most expensive Senate campaign perhaps in U.S. history. When you see this state split right down the middle and you factor in how swing voters in the November midterms are going to be viewing Republicans running for office through the prism of what may be their frustration with what's going on in Washington and with the Trump administration, are these distractions that some of these candidates can afford in this political environment right now?
Well, as Sergio said, we've got the dynamic of essentially two very different campaigns that are going to be occurring in the next year. The primary is because independents, which are one-third of the electorate, do not vote in them. They are the candidates that are running in those races have to appeal to the extremes. And then they have to, within 4 weeks before early voting starts, somehow revise their message and move to the middle. That's going to make, I think that is why Democrats haven't really been campaigning against Donald Trump. They haven't had to, because Donald Trump is sort of overshadowing everything. And so I think Democrats have a far easier situation for them. They don't have this division. Yes, their candidates are going to be coming out of the primary farther to the left than the middle, than most of the moderate parts of the state need or want to see. However, they don't have to then figure out whether they've got to distance themselves from the president, which is exactly what I think is the dilemma for a lot of Republicans.
305-995-1800, some political happenings around the Sunshine State, a lot of jockeying for position in the gubernatorial race, and just generally political appeals here in the late springtime. Sergio Bustos with Politico. Let me ask you about this not-so-cryptic tweet that the Speaker of the Florida House sent out this week, Richard Corcoran, saying, "I'll have a big announcement to make next week, - stay tuned." Worst kept secret in Florida politics was his interest in the governor's race. Is this confirmation of what's plainly obvious?
Yeah. It seems so. And it's always the worst kept secret. You remember Governor Scott, for months it was believed to be going to run. And then one day he says, "I have a big announcement."
Right.
And lo and behold, my God, he's running for the Senate. Who would have thought that? It's going to be tough for House Speaker Corcoran because, you know, on the whole gun issues, well, I think it's going to remain a top issue going into November. He really kind of stayed, I would say, more in the background, whereas someone like Governor Scott, you know, showed a Republican can be, can show some compromise on an issue that's very difficult. In the end, you know, the House and Senate did agree on a bill and they moved it forward and it became law. But again, I think it's something that's very difficult for him. I also think the immigration issues will pop up somehow, even though it's a governor's race and the state doesn't have that much to do with it.
Well, that's the first video that the speaker, you know, released in YouTube was an immigration video.
Yes, this whole effort about, and I don't want to get into all the politics of sanctuary cities, but the idea that localities aren't helping the federal government in tracking down illegals and undocumented immigrants. It's a tough issue in Florida because, you know, it's like one in five, one in four residents are immigrants. Again, most of them legal, but it's an issue that hits close to home for a lot
of
people.
Well, let's talk about some other political news and notes from around the state right now. If you're just tuning in, it's the Florida Roundup this Friday. Give us a call from wherever you are in the state at 305-995-1800. You know, this week brought another special election in Florida that was closely watched. On Tuesday, Democrat Javier Fernandez beat Republican Andrew Vargas in House District 114, covering part of Miami-Dade, the fourth time, everybody, since President Trump has been elected, that a Democrat has claimed a surprise victory in Florida. Democrats are pointing to this result as yet another example of what they hope will be a coming blue wave in the state. Marianne Kloss, as you pointed out, President Trump is hanging over a lot of the politics moving throughout the state right now. Is this special election a true bellwether, or were the circumstances of this race a little murkier?
Well, it's interesting because the Republicans insisted that this race in Miami take place. They didn't have to have a special election. They could have just left the position open for 6 months. Republican Carlos Trujillo was appointed by Trump to an ambassador position or OAS ambassador in D.C. And there is really no reason to have this position open unless you want to give a Republican a head start. Make him a redshirt freshman and have your designated Miami guy, Miami Republican, be the leader of his class so that he could become House Speaker in 8 years. Mm-hmm. So that was the strategy. They spent twice as much money as the Democrat, but they made a fatal mistake, and that is that this district has been leaning Democrat, and it performed that way.
And we've seen a few of these results in the last several months around the state. Can Democrats capitalize on this momentum, do you think, given the divisions that you were just referring to on the Republican side? Or is this going, are we going to, I know it's early days, but this still is a closely divided state. And it's fascinating to see these results coming in fits and starts. But what are your thoughts about the next 6 months?
I think this secured the conclusion that there has been a blue wave in Florida. The first sign of it happened with a surprising victory of a Democrat in a very Republican district in Sarasota. That was a House seat in February, and then that was preceded by Annette Tadeo winning a Republican seat that had been held by Frank Artiles in Miami in another special election. And now this is another example of a seat being turned over to Democrats. And so there's no doubt in my mind that Democrats are feeling a little more secure than Republicans in these close districts.
And maybe this is the opening that Alan Grayson sees in Central Florida, right? The former Democratic congressman wants his old job back. This week he said he challenged the incumbent Darren Soto in the Democratic primary in the 9th congressional district in Orlando. Soto won this seat back in 2016 when Grayson didn't run for re-election when he ran unsuccessfully for the U.S. Senate. It's got a large Puerto Rican voting block there in Central Florida. Soto is of Puerto Rican descent, but Alan Grayson is unfazed by that.
With the Puerto Rican vote largely behind Darren because no one contested the Puerto Rican vote last time, he managed to get all the way to 36% of the vote, with an enormous help from outside forces. I have a record of accomplishment for the Hispanic community that Darren can only dream of.
So in this blue wave of sorts we've seen with some of these special state elections, you're seeing a challenge maybe from the left on the Democratic primary here, Sergio, in Central Florida.
Yeah, this is, put it bluntly, this is the politician Democrats would like to see go away.
Grayson, meaning.
Yes,
yeah.
Alan Grayson, because he's been nothing but trouble in their eyes. And unusual in this, when Grayson announced he was going to challenge Darren Soto, he said that the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, and this is a national committee that raises money for congressional candidates across the country, really took an unusual step and say, no, we don't want you. Please run away. Get away from this race. It just causes more of a headache. And again, like we talked about earlier, and I think the Democratic divisions aren't as big, but this is another example where it just opens up a division where they didn't need to be one. And again, just a big, big headache for Democrats.
Yeah, you see House Democratic Leader Nancy Pelosi this week saying she's sad that Alan Grayson is primarying Darren Soto. Of course, Alan Grayson believes the Democratic Party should be pushing hard to call for impeachment of President Trump. Nancy Pelosi sees that as not helping her in her stated goal of winning back the House. She thinks that'll simply rally more Republicans to come out to the polls. Mary Ellen Kloss.
It is interesting that Pelosi even chose to speak up about this. I find it really surprising that Alan Grayson decided to attack Soto on his Hispanic record when, after the hurricanes, he was, one of the forces that was actually working to bring aid and assistance to Puerto Rico. And so I don't understand Alan Grayson. And he continues to, I think, baffle even
I don't think you're alone in that, Mary Ellen.
let me just say real quickly, too, about Grayson. By talking about the Hispanic vote as a monolithic vote,
right.
He already made his first mistake. It's Puerto Ricans in Central Florida. It's Cuban Americans and Venezuelans in South Florida. He's got to learn to speak to the specific audience. And again, strike number one against him among many to come, I believe.
Melissa mentioned the former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. She's been active in kind of trying to line up some support amongst Florida Democratic members of the Florida delegation in hopes or anticipation of a blue wave returning the Democrats to power as the majority in the House of Representatives. Mary Ellen, you first, and then Sergio, kind of, how does she play in Florida? Does she help Florida Democrats in the 2018 campaign?
Well, not if Democrats want to win the middle. I think she is perceived by the loyalist in the party as a very effective fundraiser and a leader, but I think she's toxic when it comes to her reputation generally. And so, there is a consistent blind spot from the establishment Democrats around the country about what it's like to be a Democrat in the South, and they just have a tin ear about the resistance to kind of their brand. And I do think that if she shows up and is at all working hard or campaigning much, that could be trouble for them. The Republicans can use Nancy Pelosi as an effective tool against Democrats.
And certainly they have over the years fundraised off her presence politically. But one thing we know, it's never a boring week in Florida politics. So thank you, Mary Ellen Kloss. She's the Tallahassee Bureau Chief for the Miami Herald, with us from WFSU in Tallahassee. Sergio Bustos, Senior Editor for Politico in Doral. Thank you both for joining the show.
Thank you.
It's good to be here.
And in a moment, how to pay for Florida's public schools, how to keep children safe. More questions here on the Florida Roundup. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup, our statewide edition this Friday. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville.
And I'm Tom Hudson in Miami. Florida's public schools are trying to figure out how to keep their campuses safe, Melissa, and really how to pay for it, too. after the mass shooting at the Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland last February. Lawmakers passed a comprehensive safety bill that contains $400 million. Some of it is aimed toward helping keep schools secure with armed personnel.
That's right. Now, before the law was passed, lawmakers heard from sheriffs and school superintendents that the financial allocation for all of this, well, it wasn't enough, they said. And now the funding is actually falling short, Tom, of what districts need in order to add an armed officer on every campus. Critics are calling this whole thing, and we hear this term a lot in Florida, an unfunded mandate.
Yeah, we certainly do. You know, some districts are employing guardian programs as a workaround here. School staff members are being trained to carry a weapon on campus instead of having an armed guard or a police officer there.
Now, the Hendry County School District is among the districts that have already taken some steps to arm school staff members. The school board there approved participation in the Guardian program. That's a provision of the Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School Public Safety Act. The Hendry County Sheriff's Office says it's going to run the program. Selected staff members, not including teachers, will be trained and allowed to carry concealed weapons at school. Deputy Superintendent at Hendry County School District Lucinda Kelly says they haven't asked for volunteers, but instead they've identified people they thought might be interested in serving as a guardian.
And that's the step we're on right now, is identifying those people. And I would say we're pretty close to done with that. I'm sure we'll add people as we go, but we have preliminary lists ready to go. And the Sheriff's Department is at the step where they're finalizing the training portions that have to be done so that they will feel good about exactly meeting the requirements of the law.
Now, last year, there were about 1,500 officers at Florida Public Schools, but there are 3,800 schools across the Sunshine State and the Panhandle down to the peninsula, and each one of them has to have armed security under this new law.
Give us a call here on the Florida Roundup. Let us know what you think about how this is playing out in your school district.
Mr. Solacek?
Let's go now to Julie Glenn. She's news director at WGCU. And Julie, has this Hendry program in the schools, has it already gotten underway? What do things look like in your corner of the state?
In Hendry County, as was just indicated by the deputy superintendent, they're in the process right now of identifying people that might be good candidates to join in this Guardian program. They are still just selecting those people. They said that they didn't want to open it up like, here, sign up here to volunteer, but it is strictly a volunteer basis. So if they approach someone and they don't feel comfortable joining into this program, then they won't. So next up is for the Sheriff's Department to come up with instituting all of the training and requirements that would be necessary, and also put in place the testing that would happen, and that would be under the provision of the Sheriff's Department there. And the next is hopefully they hope to have the people in place in the schools in Hendry County by the beginning of the fall semester.
Julie, what do you know about the decision by Hendry County to go in the Guardian route here as opposed to school resource officers or something else?
Well, when I was talking with the deputy superintendent, she told me that the sheriff in the county, his name's Steve Whidden, as far back as Sandy Hook, he was very disturbed by that. And since then, he has worked to have school resource officers in all of the schools anyway. So he was a big advocate and proponent for bringing this Guardian program to the school district, in addition to already having the school resource officers there. So he really was kind of pulling for it. They had a couple of different town hall meetings at which they heard from the public their opinions and feelings on participating in that. But the school district found that not a lot of teachers were or school personnel were at those meetings necessarily, because they didn't want to have to make an opinion known and then have to defend it. So then they decided to put out a questionnaire, really an anonymous questionnaire, with only two questions. Do you support this? And then at what level are you in the school system? Are you an administrator or a teacher? And are you in a middle school or an elementary school or a high school? They ended up finding that 63.9%, almost 64% of the participants were in favor of joining this program, and 36.1% opposed it. And anecdotally, the deputy superintendent told me that a lot of the teachers that she talked with said they want to have someone there that's trained and able to protect them and and the students, but they don't want to be the ones necessarily carrying the concealed weapons.
Yeah, Jeff Solacek with us now. He is the education reporter for the Tampa Bay Times. Jeff, overwhelmingly, it seems educators in the state did not want to arm themselves. And based on your reporting, different districts seem to be responding to this in different ways. What are you observing as you look at this all around Florida?
We have seen a variety of approaches from the school districts that are hiring a new type of security guard that they're likening to the Guardian program, but they're not teachers. They're hiring these people directly in to become trained security guards at their schools. That we're seeing that in Duval and Polk counties. Pasco County are looking at those kinds of programs. Some of the schools are sticking with their police departments and expanding them. Sarasota County is creating its own new internal school district police force to handle some of the schools that the SROs are not handling. And then there are the districts that are just going full out for school resource officers and saying that they're working with law enforcement if possible to cover the costs, because that's the best way to get a trained person in the school who knows what they're doing with a gun to protect people.
Jeff, to cover the cost here, how much of these decisions have you been able to discern from these districts are driven by economic necessity versus speed and to comply with the law by the next school year?
Well, they're trying to do both. They do have to comply because it's now the law, and a lot of the districts don't have enough money. The legislature put $400 million into all of these programs, but that, the districts are finding, is just not enough to do what they need to do to get a person, an armed guard or an officer into every school. So they're trying to save money so that they can afford everything else that they need to do. And a lot of times these safety guard, security guard programs are the fallback positions that districts don't want to do, but it's the thing that they can afford.
It's 305-995-1800. What are your thoughts about how Florida school districts are implementing a new law around school security that requires armed security in the school campus? Let's go to Jessica now in Key West. Hi, Jessica. You're on the Florida Roundup. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. This is a really interesting program. I just wanted to share an anecdote. I'm a parent at a tiny public charter school, one of two charter schools here in Key West. We have fewer than 200 students, and we're a Montessori charter school, so it's wonderful. It's free K-8 Montessori education for the Lower Keys. But we're looking at this and talk about an unfunded mandate. You know, we are short a couple of teachers right now, and we're looking at having to hire a resource officer who will make far more, so the kind of rumor has it, will be paid far more than any of our teachers, possibly more than our head of school. And we will then possibly not be able to hire a teacher.
Where are you hearing that, Jessica?
And is it's nothing is exactly, nothing's totally confirmed. But we are being, I mean, Monroe County is, I'm last I've heard the school board here is you know, really not interested in training up guardians, which is great. Our school, you know, no one is interested in there being staff. None of the staff are interested in carrying firearms. But it looks like a very, you know, real possibility that
will. Yeah, so then you're left with having to go out and hire a trained,
right,
fully trained
and
police officer.
We have a shortage here in Key West. We have a shortage of housing shortage. Yeah. I mean, we're short on police officers, you know, never mind hiring resource officers. So it's really put our entire city in a bit of a bind.
And it's interesting to hear a perspective from all the way down at the very southern tip of Florida. Julie Glenn, Jeff Solacek. Here in Duval County, up on the northeastern tip of Florida, a big urban school district, Jacksonville, there has been debate about the solution the Duval County School Board has hit upon because they simply didn't have the budget to fulfill the mandate robustly. So they are requiring, I think it's less than 200 hours of training, and they're going to be paying the armed security in the Duval schools about $20,000 a year. That's leading parents to say they don't feel that that's enough training or enough pay to get quality people into these roles. it's controversial whether you're in Key West or whether you're in Jacksonville or anywhere in between.
It sure is, and we're finding that the school districts are trying to balance all of these demands. Some people want very safe schools. I went and talked with some students who are concerned because their campuses are so wide open, and maybe having one even law enforcement officer isn't enough because he could be on the far side of a campus and another person might help. And then you have people who don't want an untrained security guard. Basically, 132 hours is all that the law requires. And they don't want somebody who's that ill-trained to be in there. They trust a police officer more.
Julie Glenn, let me ask you about some other counties in Southwest Florida. It's an interesting area. You're reporting at WGCU in Fort Myers. You talked about Hendry County, which is a relatively rural county. But what about Lee and Collier counties that has a much more of a arguably metropolitan makeup?
So far, Collier County has been playing it a little close to the vest. They have not said that they are going to be participating in this program as yet. And in Lee County, they have hired a security professional that's going to be overseeing security for throughout the district. They have said so far that they do not have plans to implement this program as far as, you know, training people right at their schools.
305-995-1800. School security officers or guardians required by the Marjorie Stoneman Act, this new state law here in Florida passed after the February massacre in Parkland. Your phone calls, 305-995-1800. In Northport, Raymond is online too. Go ahead, Raymond. You're on the radio.
Hi. So two questions. One is, how does it work with this law? Do they also have to cover the technical schools and the community colleges? And then the separate question is in regards to insurance. So if a guardian, not an officer, but a guardian involved in a shooting and injures a student or worse, how are they covered for liability? And is there insurance in place to help with the medical needs of this the students?
Gotcha. Let me go to that first point, Jeff. Who is covered? Which schools are required to have these security guards in place? We heard from a Montessori charter school in Key West that is wrestling with this.
Yes, all the public schools, K-12, are the schools that are included in this law. I believe that the technical schools that are associated with school districts are also involved. Community colleges, I am not 100% sure, but I don't think that they were included in that law. And so the charter schools are in a real interesting position because some school districts are willing to provide them as part of their service, and some are saying, you already get some of our safe schools money, so good luck hiring them yourself. Hmm.
And Julie, what about Raymond's question about the insurance and the liability insurance, let alone the medical insurance involved with the Guardian program, for instance, that Hendry County is exploring?
Well, it was really interesting because that was one of the points that the school board members really got hung up on during the meeting last week, at which they eventually voted 4-1, 4-4-1 against joining this program. There was a lot of discussion about how the liability insurance is going to shake out. The superintendent of schools was there, and he said that he believed that existing insurance would umbrella that. However, if that came to be seen as not possible, and if it was going to essentially add to the bottom dollar of insuring this, that is something that they could use as cause to come back and revisit whether or not they wanted to continue with the implementation of this program. So one of the school board members seemed comforted by that and essentially voted in favor of it after being assured that they could, without penalty, back out of being in part of this program.
And we're talking school safety here on the Florida Roundup, our statewide edition from Florida Public Radio. Let's go to Kathleen in Miami this afternoon. Hey, Kathleen, how are you?
Hello. I'm fine, thank you.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'd just like to know how this would work. We have some schools here in Miami. I'm only speaking about Miami because this is the only place I know about. Some schools have 1,600 students plus, and other schools have much less. So how do you put one officer in a 1,600 plus school and one officer in a less number of populated school. And wouldn't you require two or three people in a school with 1,600 students?
Yeah, thanks for that question. Jeff Solacek, as we saw at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, that was a pretty big campus.
3,200 students.
Yeah, yeah, and some schools are a lot larger than others. What about Kathleen's question?
Well, the legislature said a minimum of one. They want to make sure there's at least one at every school. But yes, there are large schools that are on spread out campuses, and school districts are looking at how they can get more than one person. They think that that would be the best answer if they can. But right now they're looking at the numbers and they're saying, how are we going to find enough people just to put one on every campus?
You know, it's interesting to note, too, that when this legislation passed, critics at the time, Julie Glenn, Jeff Solacek, said that there would be an enormous focus on hardening schools and not enough of a focus on looking at the root causes of why we have a problem with school shootings. And so as you look at the nuts and bolts of this legislation, Jeff Solacek, are you getting feedback from educators and parents about the deeper issues around this? Or are parents just more concerned right now with, let's make sure these physical campuses are safe?
Parents do want to make sure their schools are safe. We're seeing a lot of them keep their kids home just on a threat that they see on social media, saying that they're frightened, scared, and even more scared than scared. But they are also talking about some of the mental health issues that are coming up. There was a lot of money put into increasing services for that. Superintendents held a meeting in Orlando not long ago, and individual districts are having public forums talking about what they can do to make sure that students receive the mental health services that they need, and families as well, so that they can start to get at some of those root causes as to what might make somebody bring a gun to school.
Jeff, I'm wondering, for districts that continue to wrestle with this, number one, is there a mechanism for them to go back to the state for additional funding? And two, if they do not meet the threshold of one officer, a minimum of one officer per school, what's the penalty?
I don't know that there is a penalty, to be quite honest. They just are told that they have to do it, and they want to do it. Nobody wants to be the school or the school district that said, we don't have one. As far as the money goes, the governor has said in a letter that he sent out to superintendents that if the money that was set aside for the Guardian program is not fully used by the deadline, that he's going to work with the Department of Education and lawmakers to reallocate that to other programs that schools can use. Okay. As far as more money, that would come in a future session.
Jeff Solacek is the education reporter at the Tampa Bay Times. He's been joining us via Skype. And Julie Glenn, our colleague at WGCU Fort Myers, the news director there on the Gulf Coast. To both of you, thanks for joining us on the Florida Roundup. We've got plenty more to come, including whether or not the state is upholding its end of the education bargain. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup, the statewide edition this hour. Thanks again for listening to public radio here in the Sunshine State. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville.
The Florida Supreme Court has finally agreed to take up the question of whether state lawmakers are adequately funding public school education. Big question here, Melissa. The state constitution, after all, guarantees, quote, a uniform, efficient, safe, secure, and high-quality system of free public schools.
That's right. And that phrase, high quality, is what parents have zeroed in on, Tom. And this has been a long time coming. This group of parents first sued the state over this issue way back in 2009. They say lawmakers are violating the Florida Constitution by not meeting proper funding requirements. One of those parents is Jacksonville's Eunice Barnum.
I am just so happy that it has gotten this far. We're hoping that it will bring more funding for resources so that the schools will be better equipped to teach and provide the services that children are in need of.
Now, a trial court and an appeals court had ruled that the decision was out of their jurisdiction. So now, here it comes to the state's highest court. They will consider whether the Florida legislature is not fulfilling its duty to adequately fund public education in the state. No court date yet announced, but give us a call and let us know what you think about this. At 305-995-1800, do you think the schools are adequately funded or not? Let's continue our discussion now with Jeff Solacek, education reporter with the Tampa Bay Times. Jeff, it's been an education in terms of the legal system to watch how this case has wound its way through the courts. They've been waiting almost 10 years to get this hearing.
Yeah, some of these cases take a very long time because just getting all the information together and getting it into the proper position to be heard, there's a lot of depositions and things that need to take place. And some of these cases last years in all sorts of states, all over the country.
Here's a tweet about this from a listener named Julie. We pay taxes, but the legislature won't let us recoup the benefit of rising property taxes to fund our schools. Per pupil funding is stagnant since 2007. Florida has been shortchanging education and school safety for two decades. And then she puts in the hashtag, vote them all out. Jeff Solacek, when you look at per pupil funding year over year, it is largely stagnant. So what's the likelihood that the state Supreme Justices will be sympathetic to this argument or not?
Well, they have to take up the issues that are in front of them. And the first one is whether those words that you mentioned at the beginning, efficient and high quality, are things that they can actually determine. Mm-hmm. And the first two courts that took up this case said that that's really subjective and it's not something that they can measure and say whether the state is meeting that as its paramount duty. And that's what they said in 1998 when they amended the state constitution, that education would be a paramount duty of the state in the constitution. So if they can get past that, whether it's subjective or not, then they can start discussing whether it's enough.
Because the appeals court have ruled that it's not the court to decide those subjective phrases and kind of, you know, cancel the case, so to speak. But by virtue of the Supreme Court taking up the case, Jeff, isn't it giving us a little bit of a hint at the at what it's going to play? That it, clearly it sees that the Supreme Court has a role in deciding this.
It might just be to say, we agree and we want to set this straight once and for all, that the legislature sets the budgets for education. That is their purview. We don't know what their actual thinking is, but they are taking it up. So there is the chance that they may say there is standing, there is room to discuss this, and now let's get into the nuts and bolts of this situation. Is the state diverting money away from public education, not funding it well enough to meet its paramount duty?
Jeff, if they get to that point and decide to get that nuts and bolts, what's at stake here? I mean, are we talking about a third of the state budget, which is about what we spend in Florida on education, K through 12 plus higher education? But is that what we're really talking about? Essentially, 30 cents out of every dollar spent by the state of Florida on trial?
It could be more, because if they say that it's not enough that's being spent with that one third, those more than $20 billion, then they could direct the legislature to find a formula that directs more money into the system. And then they would have to decide either how to get more money or someplace else to cut.
When was the last time the legislature took up the school funding formula?
Well, they take it up every year and they adjust it and tweak it.
But did they really have they really tweaked it substantially in years? I mean, it's been tweaked, but has it really been looked at in a comprehensive way, other than the measures that have made their way through the legislature that in particular allocate more funding toward charter schools? And that has been controversial as well. You could expect some of those arguments to come up when the justices hear this case.
That's true. The actual program, which they call the FEFP, has basically been the way that it's been for probably four decades or longer. And then they've worked around the edges of trying to make it fit into the policy ideas that they like at the time.
The larger urban school districts, certainly here in South Florida and elsewhere, have argued in this past legislative session, Jeff and Melissa, that the formula was tweaked in such a way that the larger districts were essentially penalized by not getting as much of an increase in the per pupil spending as smaller, more suburban and rural districts.
That's true. They implemented a new formula that basically tried to make sure that school districts that are smaller and that don't have as large of property bases were able to get some additional funding. And the larger school districts like Miami and Broward really did suffer as a result of that. You see them on a per student basis down towards the bottom of the state list.
Yeah. And one of the interesting parts, Melissa, about the tweet that you read from Julie talking about we pay taxes, legislature won't let us recoup the benefit of rising property taxes. Jeff, we've seen this in many legislatures where they don't want to be accused, the Republicans don't want to be accused of a tax increase by keeping the funding formula in a way that takes advantage of rising property values and thus rising property taxes.
That's right. The state has frequently, because of the way that the state defines what a property tax increase is, the rising value of property would bring in more money, and so therefore that's considered to be a tax increase, even though it's not a tax rate increase. And that's been the battle between the Republicans, basically, and the Democrats for the past number of sessions. And they have won out, the people who want to say, we're not raising taxes, and so therefore we're going to lower the tax rates so we don't bring in any more money.
And you're listening to the Florida Roundup, our statewide edition from Florida Public Radio. Very quickly, Jeff, these lawsuits have intensified around the country, not just in Florida, as states have recovered financially from the Great Recession. You're seeing an aggressive push around the country in Kansas, Pennsylvania, other states, from plaintiffs demanding that lawmakers more fully fund the school systems, and a shift in strategy, too, in the way that the legal strategy is playing out. This is a national trend, not just a Florida story.
Definitely. Especially when you've seen some of the ways that they had to cut schools in some of the states, now they feel like they're not operating well enough and they're not providing good enough services. And so families are fighting back.
We've seen teachers striking all over the country over school budgets as well. Although in researching that here in Florida, I believe a statute was passed decades ago after a statewide strike that teachers in Florida technically by law are not allowed to strike. Isn't that right?
That's correct. And so the large teachers union, the Florida Education Association, has urged teachers not to strike because they could lose their benefits, they could lose their pensions, and they could lose their pay, obviously, and possibly their certification. And they don't want them to do that, but they're trying to find other ways to fight back. There are some groups on social media sites that are saying we need to do something to fight back, to get people to know our plight and to try and get us more money, more respect in the school system. It's an ongoing battle. And we saw with the latest legislative session that the love for unions was not very high in Tallahassee.
And certainly teachers' unions specifically, right?
Correct.
Yeah. Jeff, who are the parties in this case? In other words, kind of, you know, who's the plaintiff? Who's the defense?
The plaintiff are some parents from, they originally were from four counties, mm-hmm. and I'm not sure exactly who all remains because over 10 years, some people come and go. But they're largely parents, and they're supported by some of the lawyers who were involved even in the 1998 Constitution revision. John Mills was part of that commission at that
former
time.
Former Speaker of the House in Florida, right.
Right, and he actually is their lawyer. And then you have on the other side the state, which has to...
with the Attorney General Pam Bondi taking the lead here.
Well, yeah.
Or her office, at least.
Her office,
yeah,
exactly.
Right. Supreme Court decision here to watch, certainly, no doubt about it, on education and the public payment for it. Jeff Solacek, along with us, the education reporter, with us via Skype from the Tampa Bay Times.
Well, Tom, you can't get more Florida than this. Here in our state, surrounded by water on all sides, we saw the opening last weekend of the first ever man-made lagoon in the nation.
Trying to improve a little bit maybe on Mother Nature here, Melissa.
Yeah.
It's a 7.5-acre lagoon. It's called the Epperson Project, spearheaded by the Crystal Lagoon Company, which has built these massive pools all over the world. This one is near Tampa. The lagoon here, it offers things like poolside restaurants, swim-up bars, an inflatable obstacle course. There's a family beach, a lawn for yoga, and even a tidal pool.
You know, we have the real thing in this state. I don't know if you've heard about that. But the faux swimming hole is expected to attract swimmers, kayakers, stand-up paddleboarders, even sailing enthusiasts. When the entire project is completed, it will also host more than 2,000 new homes. Again, lots of sand and water that's already available, but This is Florida, Tom. I think anything goes here, right?
All the sunshine, though, is natural.
That's right. That's our show for today. The Florida Roundup is produced by WJCT Public Broadcasting in Jacksonville and WLRN Public Media in Miami. Gina Jordan and Kevin Merschart are producers.
Jason Zabka is our technical director. WLRN's program director is Peter Maris. Our theme music is provided by Miami jazz guitarist Aaron Libos at aaronlibos.com. I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week.